This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the story behind the story, the news behind the news, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at and illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality and not illusion or delusion that's going to determine just what the future will bring. Now, I want to introduce to you Dr. Lawrence Dunnigan. And Dr. Dunnigan is a pediatrician. He practices in the eastern part of the United States. And he's been practicing for 30 years. But some 28 years ago, he heard a fascinating lecture given by Dr. Day, who had been a professor at the medical school he had attended. And this talk was given to a group of young doctors with the proviso that nobody would take notes and nobody would record what was said. Dr. Day then went on to become a director of the Planned Parenthood Federation. So right now, let's introduce Dr. Dunnigan. Dr. Dunnigan, it's so good for you to be with us, or to have you with us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
All right, fine. Well, why don't you just give our listeners the background of this incredible, incredible story you heard 28 years ago, which is so prophetic as far as what's unfolding today. And let me just, for the listener, comment that one of the things that was said 28 years ago was we would have sex without reproduction and reproduction without sex. Yes. And as we begin thinking about the artificial insemination and now the new cloning process, you realize that what was said 28 years ago to a young pediatrician is all coming to pass today, a part of a long-range plan of a group of men who do have an agenda. So why don't you pick up the story from there?
Well, when we sat down to listen to the lecture, we were all expecting something clinical. Dr. Day, his areas of primary research concern had always been newborn, premature birth, and the problems with carnicterus coming from neonatal jaundice and temperature control in premature babies. So we were all expecting something scientific, and as the presentation unfolded, it was quite a surprise because there was nothing scientific. It was all what we might call sociologic. And as you alluded to, while ago, Dr. Day had indicated that he wanted to see nobody taking notes or using a tape recorder because the things he was going to talk about, actually he said in the process, if you ever quote me on these things, I will deny them. He seemed to be indicating that there could be some sort of physical danger to him for speaking out about such things. That was more a suggested, I think, rather than an explicit statement. But, you know, when you hear that sort of thing very early in what you're anticipating to be a scientific presentation, that really caught my attention. You know, what are you going to be telling us that could put you in some danger one way or another? So, anyway, as the presentation unfolded, began by stating that anybody with an eighth grade education could do the arithmetic and determine that the Earth would soon be overpopulated if there were no limits put on human reproduction. And part and parcel of the overpopulation then would be outgrowing our natural resources and overpollution of the planet. These people always refer to the world or the Earth as the planet. So in the beginning, it seemed as though the presentation was almost an apology for things that we would in the audience find unpalatable. But there were several times in the presentation where he would say, this is the only way. There's no other way. This is sort of implying that he knew these things would maybe not sound acceptable to many, if not all, in the audience. So the thing that he really, this whole thing hung on was population control. And up until that time, I had heard, most of us had heard that term, population control. To me, it primarily meant limiting births. By the end of the presentation, I realized that population control has a much, much broader meaning than just limiting the number of births and even who or who may not be allowed to give birth. Because the presentation covered just every human endeavor, education, employment, industry, entertainment, sports, toys for children, clothing, a whole bunch of things that maybe we can get into as we go on here as time allows. But mentioning, as you did, sex without reproduction and reproduction without sex, that was an important part of this. Also, money and banking, which was toward the end of his presentation. The cashless society, the move from cash to credit cards to a single credit card to a single identifying card, and then ultimately at the end, because cards can be lost or stolen, some sort of implant under the skin. In those days, silicone implants were under the very first stages of development. Silicone is inert, so the body tends to tolerate it fairly well. And this implant then could serve as identification and be an element in carrying on commerce, which, as I say, would replace cash, replace checks from a checking account, replace plastic credit cards, which back at that time were starting to really accelerate in use. So that all of these items that serve your financial and banking needs also would serve for identification. And this could be implanted. I'm laughing because at the time he said, some of you hearing this will right away think there's a religious connotation here. And at that time, I had no idea what he's referring to. I was not much of a Bible scholar. And then it was only later that I read the book of the Apocalypse about the mark of the beast on the hand of the forehead. And I made the connection, and I realized why he said what he said.
Did he tell you what the relationship was to banking and international finance, or was this just a casual remark about the fact that we would progress to a situation or a society where everybody would be marked and identified?
He went... the presentation was that... the changes that he was projecting from then, 1969, the target date to have them all in place was the turn of the century.
The year 2000, right.
Give or take a few years according to how well it would progress, but that was where they were shooting. And this was worldwide, not just the United States or not just United States, Europe, and so-called Western civilization. But this was to be global, the entire world.
Now, did he tell you who was going to be doing it, or was it just it's going to happen and there's some group behind this?
It's going to happen. He never used a proper noun. He used only one proper noun in the entire presentation. That it was the Rockefeller Institute.
Now, what was the tie of the Rockefeller Institute into this? Now, did he say?
That had to do with... research and the treatment of cancer.
And there was something about they had treatments for cancer, but they didn't want to release them because we had to have people dying off. What was that?
Yes, that's just about what it was, that many or most cancers now could be cured. Now, this is back in 1969. Many or most cancers now are curable, but the information has been held in Rockefeller Institute files, because imagine what would happen if people stopped dying of cancer.
And, of course, that's exactly what Thomas Malthus wrote about back in 1800. You know, we had to have people dying so we could have new people born.
Mm-hmm.
Fascinating. Okay, well, just I pardon me for interrupting you, but I just wanted to bring that fact out. So this is 28 years ago. You're hearing the predictions of what the future holds for the world. So why don't you pick it up from there?
Well, I'm just trying to recall where he started. There was this general overview about controlling birth, who may or may not be allowed to have birth, implying that certain people would be not allowed to have children. Most people would be allowed two. Exceptional people might be allowed three, but never more than that. The replacement statistic that is widely quoted is 2.1 births per couple. The 0.1 meaning, two would replace the two parents, and then the 0.1 is because of some untimely deaths of disease or accident or whatever, so replacement levels felt to be just a little above two. In that context, too, he mentioned that something we feel that we can accelerate and control evolution. And this was in a context of controlling who might be allowed to reproduce. In other words, if your genes were acceptable, you would be allowed to bear children. But if they were not, you might be forbidden to bear children. That's when the business about sex without babies and babies without sex got some development in that certain people who had desirable genetic characteristics that should be perpetuated for the good of the world would be encouraged to reproduce, but they need not reproduce in the natural way through sexual intercourse, but this could be all done in the laboratory. Then, along those lines, the question which he anticipated, by the way, I should say there was no opportunity for any of us in the audience to ask any questions, but because the sexual instincts are so strong, he said you might think that at first we would try to de-emphasize sex, but that's nearly impossible to do because the feelings are so strong. So the plan is to go the other way, to encourage sexual activity, promote sexual desire, but do it in such a way that it's directed away from reproduction. And part and parcel of that then was the promotion of contraceptive devices. They would be promoted in such a way that it would be just instinctive, natural, that when you were thinking about sex, you would automatically connect it to contraception, that sex without contraception would be sort of a deliberate mental process, but most sexual activity would be linked to contraception. Now, how do you do that? Well, sex education in the schools.
And was he talking about sex education and its importance back there in 1969?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he developed that to some extent, that this would be taught in the schools. Kids would be taught see, the birth control pill was, it was 69, the birth control pill came in about...
It was around in the early 60s, wasn't it, mid-60s?
Yeah, early to middle 60s.
Right.
And so this was all fairly new stuff. And, of course, he talked about things that had been around a while, too, condoms and diaphragms. but that this would be taught in the schools, the use of these. I remember that particularly because as he was saying this, I was recalling some of my teachers from high school and say, oh, I can remember Miss So-and-so, but, you know, she would never feel that she could talk about these things. Of course, I was thinking of one of my algebra teachers. he was talking about something entirely different. But, you know, that was a connection I made in my mind that in my high school this never would have gone off the ground.
Now, you were frantically taking notes all during this lecture on napkins that you had, so that nobody would really realize you were taking notes because you'd been asked not to, but you sensed that this was important, so you were recording this for posterity at the time.
Yes. Many of the things that he said I had heard before from other sources, primarily one source, which I considered to be unreliable. And I'd heard it at length with some repetition to the point where actually it became annoying to me. And I dismissed it because I considered the source not reliable. And here, then it was a few years later, see, the first I'd heard it was from this viewpoint. I stand out here seeing over there that there's a conspiracy going on. It's very broad-based. It's very pervasive. It's very subtle. Nobody knows it. And only a few of us who are able to see this know what's going on. Well, I dismissed that. Well, then here in 1969, I heard from the other end, I'm part of it. I know what's going on. I've been told what's going on. I've been privy to certain privileged information, and here it is. So, you know, hearing all this stuff from a different perspective, I'm not an outsider looking in, I'm an insider speaking out the window to you. Believe me, that had quite an impact. So that most of the things he said I had heard before. And then as the talk unfolded and, quite frankly, was offensive in many ways to me, it wasn't things that I was hearing for the first time, but rather confirming some things that I had heard before, like the relocation of industries, breaking down our armed forces, shipping our jobs overseas so that unemployment would go up. Those were some that I'd heard before and would not believe.
But, of course, one of the things he talked about was how we were going to encourage people to buy foreign products because we were intentionally going to produce shabby cars in America so that people would buy Japanese. And, of course, in 1969, most people would have thought that was crazy talk. But what did he say along that line with the idea that this would then justify the shifting of American industries to foreign countries?
Yeah, this was to establish the global economy. The idea would be we would have one global worldwide commercial system. It wasn't his term originally, but he alluded to what they call the Declaration of Interdependence. I think it was Buckminster Fuller who wrote that. It's sort of a parody or takeoff on Jefferson's Declaration of Independence for our country. And it's been a while since I've read that, but the opening sentences of the Declaration of Interdependence are an echo of our Declaration of Independence. And the idea is that every part of the world should be involved in a single economy, with different parts of the world having emphasis on different aspects of a global economy. And the United States was to be the information center. Our smokestack industries were to be sent to other countries.
Then did he explain how that would come about?
Just that the people who make the decisions, the captains of industry and politicians would get together and decide we'll close a steel mill here and reopen it there.
Now, what was this about building in obsolescence to American cars so that they'd break down and people would become disillusioned with our vehicles and buy Japanese?
Yes, the idea was to promote specifically the Japanese auto industry. This was a principle that was applied other ways, but they wanted to build up the hard industries in Japan and not eliminate ours, but de-emphasize them. So that the way to do this was if you bought an American-built car and the door handle kept coming off or the window crank would fall off or some piece under the hood that should have been made of metal was made of plastic and it would crack. And you would become irritated by that. And then your neighbor who had a Japanese car would say, well, I've driven this for so many years and so many thousands of miles, and all I do is change the oil and the tires.
Well, and did Dr. Day actually talk about this?
Well, yeah, he said this was in the plans.
This was the long-range plan as of 28 years ago to begin orienting Americans towards buying foreign products by intentionally creating inferior products in America. I know my wife was saying the other day that she doesn't hate to buy anything, clothing made in America, because it just falls apart, you know. The threads come out, the buttons pop off, and, you know, of course, she attributed this just to, you know, accidental shoddy workmanship, but... you're suggesting that maybe there is a plan, at least as far as certain of our products, to discourage Americans from buying them, to actually buy them overseas, thus transferring America's wealth, industry, and production to other nations as we then lose jobs here in America?
Right, right. I remember this particularly because, as a matter of fact, I probably was laughing to myself, as I do now when I recall it.
Thinking this, they could never get away with this.
Well, I was a child during World War II, and I remember that we always laughed at things that were stamped made in Japan.
Right, I remember that too.
And we were very proud that American-made goods were more reliable and more enduring. And so this was a complete about-face. That which was made in Japan now was going to be the superior product and ours the inferior product. And part of the idea behind this was a psychological preparation that there's sort of a, shall we say, patriotism. You know, things that are made in my hometown are the best. Things that are made in my state are the best.
Things that are made in America are the best because we're the best country in the world. And they were trying to destroy that belief?
Yes, yes. So that you would say, well, I might be a patriotic American, but, gee, I can't afford to be buying second-rate stuff when I can save money buying a foreign import. So patriotism would take a back seat to economy, you know, to my personal economy. And this then would break down the kind of loyalty to your locale or to your nation and foster a more cosmopolitan citizen of the world attitude.
Destroy the love of country.
Uh-huh.
Okay, fine. I think that's such a fascinating insight into the mentality of these people who seem to have such tremendous power over education, over industry, or even over our ways of reproduction today. Well, what other sorts of things did they talk about? I remember one thing that you mentioned was how they were going to encourage sexuality and they were going to try to get people's minds oriented onto sexuality. Did they talk at all about homosexuality and how that would be used?
Yeah, that would be promoted, not just merely tolerated or permitted, but actually to be promoted. The idea being that no child ever results from a homosexual union. The business of morality, especially a religious-based morality, really would have no part in this future. Which is the present now.
it's almost, you'd laugh because it's so ridiculous what has transpired, and you either laugh or you cry.
Well, you know, between then and now, it's been quite an experience to watch this unfold right according to the script.
Right. The unfolding nightmare is the moral foundations of our once great Christian society are progressively undermined.
Consider this. If we're going to have babies without sex and sex without babies, then for a large part, we interchange the sexes. There's no real difference between men and women.
Did he stress that, how we were going to feminize men and masculinize women?
He more stressed masculinizing the women than he did feminizing the men. And this would start in youth. For example, one of the things he mentioned was that toys that were available for children would be changed. Girls would get footballs and soccer balls, and baby dolls and tea sets, you know, little domestic kits like a dustpan and broom. Some of that would disappear entirely, and other things like that would be very, very greatly de-emphasized.
In other words, trying to undermine the maternal or these rather normal instincts that women have for being housekeepers to get them more out into the labor market. And
Yes, exactly.
And certainly if they're out in the labor market, they're not going to be having children.
That's right. If mom's at home and she's enjoying her first and second baby, she's likely to say, well, it's time for third and fourth.
Right.
And I can take care of these kids because my hubby's making a reasonable living, and we can support them.
And, of course, now you can't. You have to have the woman working because of the tax system and because of the actual, not in dollar amount, but in purchasing amount, decrease in the wages of the average American working male.
Yes. Yeah, the term they use is discretionary spending. And your discretionary spending, of course, you lose all discretion because the tax collector takes it. And so you're just trying to survive. And then if mom has one or two children that she worries about while she's at work, that's enough worry for her. So she's not going to say, well, I'm going to keep my full-time career and have more children. You know, that's just gets too much to be concerned about. Worrying about daycare, getting somebody to take care of the children.
And so what we're really talking about is an organized plan of social engineering laid out many, many decades ago that is coming to fruition really in the intervening decades.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. One other thing I wanted to develop a little bit, and then we could go on, and that's about the promoting of sexual activity.
Okay.
In 1969, abortion was a crime in every one of the states. And at that time, he said, well, it won't be long until abortion not only is no longer a crime, but will be seen as a right and be tax-supported, which at that time sounded incredible. By promoting sexual activity among youngsters and linking it strongly to contraception, planners realized that more pregnancies would occur. The idea then was, that's okay. If there are more pregnancies that occur, we'll have an abortion backup. And people who would otherwise oppose abortion will change their mind when they say, well, this is my daughter who's pregnant at a young and tender age. And abortion restrictions might be okay for everybody else.
So you were saying how they were going to change our attitude towards abortion, and how in 1969, abortion was illegal in every state. So what did they plan? How were they going to change that?
Well, the idea is to promote early sexual activity among the kids, connecting it strongly with the use of contraceptives. They would be taught that the two just naturally should go together. And then with the realization that with more sexual activity, there would be more pregnancies, more contraceptive failures, one might say. but no need to worry about cluttering up the planet with unwanted babies, because abortion then would be available as a backup. And with young girls getting pregnant too early in their life, people who otherwise would maybe object to abortion when, you know, if it was in somebody else's life, would say, well, yeah, but I no longer object because this is my daughter, and I don't want her to have to carry this pregnancy to term because she's not yet mature enough to be a mother and take care of a baby. So it was sort of a win-win situation for them. It would break down resistance to abortion, as well as reinforcing continually the need for contraception or sex without babies.
As you talk about this, it sounds so diabolical, almost like the planet come right out of the pit of hell.
Yes, I think so.
And so looking back on this, as you've seen it unfolding over the last 29 years or 28 years, it must have been terribly, terribly frustrating for you seeing these things and knowing what was going on, and yet realizing that the vast majority of the American people had no idea at all what was transpiring.
It was frustrating, and even talking with some of my colleagues who heard the same presentation, and not very long afterwards, they had all seemed to forget it. They'd say, oh yeah, I remember he was here, and I remember he talked about some stuff. But as far as details and saying, well, don't you remember when he said this, that, and the other? They'd say, no, did he say that? Well, I don't know. When I say that, what comes to mind is one of my colleagues, Dr. Day had spoken about the demise pill. The demise pill, there was consideration to be given to an arbitrary age after which, you know, everybody should just pass on. The age could be set by law, 75, 80, 85, whatever seemed to be appropriate at the time, and then when you reach that age, you would be a candidate to take the demise pill. And he said this attitudes about death needed to be changed and made more, quote, realistic. So, you know, we're all headed for death one way or another, so why not do this in a very cerebral, scientific kind of way? So the idea was that when you had reached the legal age, you could have this nice banquet, sort of a farewell banquet with your family and friends, and afterwards go off and take your demise pill and sleep away peacefully. One of my colleagues, we were outside a meeting in the hospital, and there was some talk about, he was having some pain, he was coming into the hospital to get some tests and maybe have some surgery. I said, well, hey, Fred, what are you going to do at night? You know, the night before the operation, maybe you're a little restless and you can't sleep. And the nurse comes in and says, well, here's your sleeping pill. Are you going to take it? If you take it, maybe they won't have to do the operation. He just laughed. He said, did he say that? I didn't remember that. And I said, yeah, you better remember he said it.
And so they were, even back in 1969, they were talking about a more or less coerced or forced euthanasia. Did they talk at all about other countries, how they were going to control population in other countries, or the possibility of fomenting disease to control a population?
Yes. There were a couple of things there. One, there was a part of the presentation where he said new diseases will appear. They will be very difficult to diagnose. Doctors seeing these for the first time, of course, will not know what's going on. And the reason I remember this so strongly was I was fairly new in practice. And after hearing him talk about new diseases that would appear, I'd have a youngster in the office and be examining him, and I'd you know, I said, gee, he's got this fever and these symptoms, and it just doesn't add up. I wasn't, you know, absolutely certain what was going on. Well, right away, my memory would ring a bell and say, could this be one of those new diseases he was talking about? Well, as it turned out, that was not the case in my practice or with any of my kids. But in retrospect, I think he was talking about AIDS. There were some other things that were said that sort of lead me to that conclusion.
What other things were there? Because, of course, my major interest has been the AIDS epidemic. I've been battling this for over a decade. So what other things were there that, if you can recall, and I know this is a long time ago, but I just thank the Lord that you took those notes and on the napkins and then re-recorded them. What other things did he say that makes you think that perhaps the AIDS epidemic has something to do with a plan?
The continent of Africa is a very rich continent.
Now, that's what he said.
Well, I'm sort of paraphrasing.
Okay, fine,
here.
Right.
And I don't recall that this was in immediate juxtaposition to AIDS, but it was pretty close.
Okay, so, of course, the AIDS epidemic is simply decimating, depopulating Africa. The American people don't know that, but it's really happening today. And so is he talking about possible disease, Africa, or just the fact that it was such a rich, rich continent?
Well, here we have a world that's soon to be overpopulated, soon to run out of natural resources, and here's this great big continent of Africa full of resources. Now, this continent should not be left to people who have never been able to develop it. The continent should be under the control of people who know how to develop and manage all these resources. And in effect, what that means is you have to get rid of the people that are there now, not totally perhaps, but in large part, to make room for the managers to move in.
That's a frightening, frightening thing to contemplate, and yet that's exactly what is happening in Africa today.
Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing is that it's always veiled under concern and love, and we're helping you out. You know, we love all our fellow men. But there were some comments about, let's face it, not all people are equal. We all know that. Some people are not as smart, not as capable, and capable of doing only menial tasks. And there were some racial allusions there. Now, if you have a continent full of people that are not capable of doing what Europeans are capable of doing, or Europeans who have become Americans are capable of doing, then you can't leave such a large, rich continent under the control of people that can't manage it.
And the ultimate in racism, hiding behind the banner of love and compassion.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes.
Okay, fine. So basically he was talking about, did he say these diseases would be produced? Where would they come from, these new diseases that were going to come into society?
That was not explicit at the time, as I recall it. I just, the best I can recall was that they would occur. That I kept wondering, am I going to miss them? Will I ever recognize them? Or even, will I get them?
Right.
You know, would I myself succumb to something like this? But in terms of how this would be brought about, I don't think that was addressed at all.
Okay, so we begin to see, though, an active program, that not just sort of passively bringing about population control, but actively bringing about population control.
Yeah.
Were there any other points that he made as far as population control is concerned? That, you know, because these ideas are so foreign to the average listener, the idea that we would have a demise pill. In other words, we would kill older people, and we would, in 1969, the idea that we would start aborting the children of this country in mass numbers was so foreign. Did he talk at all about pushing abortion towards certain racial or ethnic groups?
that sort of grew out of talking about promoting drug use.
Well, let's get into talking about promoting drug use, because that is so important, especially today when we see drugs destroying the inner cities of America.
Not everybody deserves space on the planet. Not everybody deserves the right to marry and reproduce. So certain people have to be sort of shunted. Now, I don't mean individual selection where you identify a particular human being, but certain populations with certain group characteristics have to be shunted. Now, part of this grows out of transferring industry overseas. I thought in terms of our steel industry, where a lot of wage earners, you know, didn't have to have a lot of education, a lot of savvy to do the work and earn a wage and raise a family. But when these industries are either closed or transferred, then the wage earners don't have any place to go to earn money to raise a family. Women, this was an education. I learned a whole lot there. He said, women are attracted to men who are good providers. See, when I was a kid, I thought they were attracted to Clark Gable and the good-looking movie star. And so this was a really revelation at my age at that time. Here, this: women are attracted to men who are good providers. They don't much care what a man looks like. Whereas men are more attracted to a woman by her appearance. And also, a man identifies himself by his work. And as I thought about what he said many times in the following years, I think that's absolutely correct. I'm Joe Blow. I'm a welder. I'm John Jones. I'm a stockbroker. You know, I think it's true. We do tend to identify ourselves that way. Well, if you have no job by which to identify yourself, you're not a good provider to attract a woman to become your wife, then you're not going to have as great an opportunity to bear children. Now, if you have a whole bunch of young men who are unemployed, are not good providers, have no strong identity through their work, you know, what do these guys do when they get together? Well, there's a certain homosexual promotion there, and a certain, you know, falling into crime.
Sure.
Which I think is a natural consequence, and which was recognized.
Well, now, were you talking about crime, or were you talking about drug use? No. Where does drug use come into this whole situation?
Okay. Now, if you're young and you have no job and you have no family and no responsibilities and life is just a bore, then you're more vulnerable to abusing drugs.
Now, did he suggest that they would encourage drug use?
Yeah. Yes.
That is an incredible prediction of what the direction that these people that Dr. Day represented would be taking our society, because they had to have powerful control or powerful influence over governmental positions and governmental activities.
Mm-hmm. The idea was to create sort of neighborhoods, doesn't seem like the right word anymore, but certain areas of the cities that would be the jungle. We have progressed so far that the laws of natural selection no longer operate. This is sort of a near quote, paraphrasing. There was natural population control in previous years, predatory animals and wars and disease and such. But now that technology has nullified a lot of that, this is part of the problem of overpopulation. So since the former law of the jungle no longer applies, we would now have a new law of the jungle, and the jungle would be certain areas in primarily large metropolitan areas where people just have no opportunity, no hope. The areas would be allowed to deteriorate with the idea that as despair grew and people sought refuge in drugs and alcohol, then a certain amount of violence would be predictable. And that's okay, because that would, you know, if you die in 1969 because somebody shot you, or if you died in 1769 because a bear got you, a mountain lion got you, what's the difference? You're dead in either case. You succumb to the law of the jungle. The survival of the fittest, on the other hand, means that in a time when you had to be a crack shot with your musket and you got the mountain lion, the only difference is that now, instead of being a musketeer, now you're a computer genius. Those are the criteria by which you select who survives.
And now, of course, when Dr. Dave was making all these predictions and telling you what the future held, didn't he make some reference to the fact that everything was in place, that nothing would stop this at the present time, and so he felt at least somewhat able to reveal these things to you?
Yes. Yes, that was fairly early in the presentation that was said. That was 69, and as best I can recall, there was nothing specified as exactly what was in place now that hadn't been. But he said something that even as recently as 5 or 10 years earlier, he could not have spoken with such assurance about what the future held.
And of course, he went on then to become some sort of an official with Planned Parenthood.
He was, at the time when he spoke, he was medical director of Planned Parenthood Federation of America.
And he had been a professor at your medical school. He was a very well-known neonatologist.
Yes. Yes, and then he left here and went to Planned Parenthood Federation in New York, became disillusioned there, and I'm not sure the nature of that disillusionment, whether it was ideological or what, but he did become disillusioned with them and left.
And he has subsequently died. He's passed away.
Yes, yes. He died 8 years ago. I'd have to look and see in my file.
So he never saw his dream come to fruition, but certainly the people who are in sympathy with these ideas are seeing it unfold today as America moves into chaos and crime and drugs and new diseases developing all across America. Basically, as you look back on this, what do you think possibly motivated Dr. Day to tell you these incredible things?
Everybody asks that question, and I can only speculate. I really don't know. There was not an opportunity to ask. But I think there were a couple of things that were involved. One was that I think he had divided feelings about this. On the one hand, repeatedly saying this is the only way, there's no other alternative, feeling that somehow or another the human race would perish otherwise, and that the human race should be promoted to go on.
This is a very common position taken by elitists. Professor Quigley, who we have studied very extensively, Bill Clinton's mentor, really believed that we needed a ruling elite, else Western civilization would be destroyed. And what you're really describing is a ruling elite with a program to try to preserve at least some element of civilization?
Yes. Yes, I think that's the upfront part of it. And then in the intervening years, it has often occurred to me that what also seems to underline this is a more long-range look. You know, they talk about progress of the human race, or progressing. And one should stop and say, well, progressing toward what?
Right.
And especially when you hear somebody say, we believe now that we have the means to accelerate and control evolution. Evolution toward what? Well, I think one possibility, I don't know that I've heard anybody state this explicitly, is that we will progress toward becoming gods. Now, that sounds a little bizarre, but when you go back to read Genesis, and Adam and Eve took from the tree of knowledge, and the serpent said, "Ye shall be as gods."
In other words, what you're suggesting is what energizes these people is a spiritual force. The idea that the serpent's message that ye shall be as gods if you go along with my program.
Mm-hmm. You can evolve to a higher plane.
And as incredible as it may seem, I read many, many publications by people, these are occultic and Luciferian publications, where this is the basic underlying theme, where mankind will supplant God and bring utopia to the world.
Well, while I'm thinking about the book of Genesis, when you go to the end of that chapter, and when God expelled Adam and Eve, and he said they got to the tree of knowledge, a verse or two later, he sets a cherubim in guard of the tree of life. And I think about that, you know, we get all this sperm banks and cloning of animals and talking about cross species, fertilization. I often think about that, you know, babies without sex and sex without babies. And very early in the game, God set up a cherub. He said, they go to the tree of knowledge. I'm going to keep them away from the tree of life. Just for fun, go to Genesis and read that and see whether you find any application to what's going on today.
Well, I think that this is all prophetic. I mean, we see these things unfolding, and for people who don't know the Lord or know the Bible, these things seem impossible. For those of us, and I know you're a believer, who see these things unfolding, we see God's hand, and we also see the hand of of Lucifer in this whole incredible story. Well, are there any other points you'd like to bring out for our listeners?
Well, we were talking earlier about unisex stuff, or at least I think we alluded to it, the masculinization of women, girls. And I don't know whether you've noticed in your area, but in our area, in the last few years, the sports pages are full of girls' sports.
Girls' basketball, you know, and as if...
Is that true out your way?
Oh, yeah, sure. And we have girls' basketball teams here. They're, Olympic girls' basketball teams, girls' volleyball teams, all of these things, you know, where they're so competitive with men.
Mm-hmm. Is soccer a big thing out there?
No, we don't have soccer out here, to my knowledge.
That'll probably become...
women's soccer, you're speaking of.
Well, no... Women's and men.
Okay.
Probably someday co-educational soccer, right. I don't know. But the reason for this is that we can't have girls in lacy dresses smelling perfumey and attracting the men.
You mean if they're sweaty, they're not going to be as attractive?
Right.
Incredible, incredible. Did he actually talk about things of this sort?
Oh, yeah. That was very explicit. Girls would be made less attractive because they would be, just as you said, sweaty.
Right.
Full of, sports and just like another guy.
Right. Big muscles and all those things.
So that was one of the early parts of masculinizing women. And then, of course, another part that I don't think he put in these terms, but I interpret in these terms then is... A woman is a good woman to the extent that she mimics a man, and that is leaving her home and, you know, going out into the workforce and becoming CEO or office manager of some big outfit rather than staying home taking care of children. But along with the de-feminizing of girls, in the professional magazines that I get where drug products are advertised, there's one that shows all these girls in their soccer uniforms, mud all over them, their hair's all wet and stringy. And this is held out to the young girls as, you know, this is what you ought to be. This is what a young girl is. She's a muddy soccer player.
Right, of course. You know, we can do anything the boys can do, and we can do it better. And the competition between women and men, without realizing that we all have a place and a part to play in God's plan.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, Dr. Dennegan, it's been a fascinating, fascinating hour, and we'll be playing this afternoon and several times on our various radio programs. I want to thank you so very, very much for taking time from your busy schedule to be here on Radio Liberty, because I think your message, going along with many of the other messages that we have, begins to tie this together, and I hope our listeners will be far wiser from having heard your memories from the lecture by Dr. Day 1969, 28 years ago.
Well, it's been a pleasure to be on, and I hope it's helpful to folks.
I hope it will be too. May God bless you, and I hope maybe at some time in the future we can talk to you again.
Well, I would like that.
Bye-bye.
Thanks so much.
Right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, well, this is Dr. Stan, an amazing, amazing tape with a gentleman who I believe God has preserved him to tell us the story. And I hope that you've enjoyed this program as much as we've enjoyed bringing it to you. And so until next time, Dr. Stan, goodbye, and may the Lord be with you.